Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Past the hour, and this is the Friday before Labor Day, and hopefully in the stack a little bit of a labor story, a working folks story for this evening as we go into the long Labor Day weekend. Now, I don't think I'll be here Monday. I mean, no offense, but I'm not trying to lay down on the job or anything, but I would rather work Christmas Day than work Labor Day. That's the honest to God's truth, I would. Because my reverence is deep for working people, the hardworking people of this country and of this planet, who carry a very, very tiny minority of people who think they are vastly better than the rest of us on our backs every second of every minute of every hour of every day of every week of every month of every year of every decade of every century of every millennium. And so it goes. So, yeah, don't look for me Monday. But if something goes really sideways or, you know, if something big happens, I'll be here. But I would prefer to revere and reverence working folks on that day. Because, you know, working people are real. It's not like a lot of holidays where we spend time invoking imaginary creatures and Easter bunnies and leprechauns and things like that. Easter bunnies, leprechauns, honest Republicans, you know, imaginary animals. But anyway, so that's we got a labor story. Quick update. Last night was the first game of the middle school football season. Ferg and his team traveled to beautiful Montgomery, West Virginia to face the Valley Middle School Greyhounds. They were pasted. It was 40-20. But it's not as bad as it sounds. That 40-20 was a big case of real first half jitters, and then came back and played some pretty decent ball, just gave up a bunch of big plays, and had some of their own. So for those of you who are wondering how Ferg was, and he did get a badly stoved middle finger. This is football. That happens. He got a badly stoved middle finger, so no flipping the bird for you for a week or two, young man. It hurts, Dad. Well, good. No, he's got a badly stoved middle finger, but played hard, got a couple of good tackles. Ran a kid down from behind and tackled him with one arm without grabbing him by the shirt collar, which is nice. I enjoy going to those games. Agnes went with me. The little stadium at West Virginia Tech, I don't know, maybe Bridgemont by now or Del Monte College of Engineering, I don't know. Little stadium up there is just beautiful. It's cut right into the hillside, and it looks out over the upper Kanawha Valley. Beautiful, just beautiful. A very happy Labor Day weekend to all of you, first and foremost. And to those of you listening who are members of labor unions, not just a happy Labor Day to you, but a profound and heartfelt thank you. Because it is organized labor that brought us a Labor Day. It is organized labor that brought us a 5-day, 40-hour work week. It is organized labor that brought us things like pensions, things like unemployment compensation, things like workers' compensation, which proved to be so popular and such a good idea that it was ruined in many states by private insurance companies trying to make a profit off of the backs of crippled working people. Where have I heard that before? I could just swear I have. But thank you. Thank you. It was January the 21st, 2009, when Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid promised a room full of progressive media types, myself and Guy James in attendance among them, "Oh, we'll have a card check bill by summer." Yeah, not so much. It's summer, card check ain't here. One wonders why. One wonders what happened. I'm hard-pressed to come up with a good answer. Chinless Mitch McConnell, however, minority leader of the Senate. Did he lose that chin in an auto accident, or is it some sort of congenital birth defect, or is he just an alien from another planet? I'm not sure. But at any rate, on the second day of September, Mitch McConnell gave a speech to Commerce Lexington. I guess that's the Chamber of Commerce of Lexington, Kentucky. And he said, Chinless Mitch did, while there's a whole bunch of crickets on employee free choice over on the Democratic side of the United States Senate, you know, that it passed the House a long time ago and would pass again. Mitch McConnell told Commerce Lexington that no Republicans, not one, zero, will vote in favor of the Employee Free Choice Act. Not a single Republican will vote to enshrine the guarantees of freedom of association contained in the First Amendment in our labor law. Not one. Not one. And unlike Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell knows how to crack a whip over his caucus. And when he says no Republican will vote for the Employee Free Choice Act, he means zero Republicans will vote for the Employee Free Choice Act, because to do so would imperil every last vestige of power that they hold. And he will wield that power ruthlessly. Chinless Mitch. Chinless Mitch says that the only reason anyone's interested in the Employee Free Choice Act is because the AFL-CIO wants to raise its membership. There was no one there to call him a scurrilous blackguard or a miserable liar, both of which he is. This is the quote. Private sector union membership has declined from a high of 35% in the 1950s to 7.5% now. And he went on to explain that that had taken place, but, quote, because we have very enlightened management in this country now, treating employees better, and employees have decided they don't want to pay the dues. Really? Really, Chinless Mitch, how many of those hardworking employees who don't want to pay the dues have health care? How many of the hardworking people at Wally World, one of your contributors, can afford full coverage for their entire family? I would say probably not a lot of them, Chinless Mitch, because after all, you got to remember that your client, Walmart, gives seminars to its workers so that they can go and collect every dime of welfare they've got coming and still keep showing up to work at Walmart every day, day in and day out. Taxpayers are paying. All over this country, taxpayers are paying, including Walmart employees themselves who pay taxes in their own right, are paying for Walmart jobs. And they're jobs that don't even include adequate health care or a meaningful pension. We have very enlightened management in this country now, treating employees better, and employees are decided they don't want to pay the dues. What about those butchers at Walmart some several years back who did want to pay the dues and organized, and Walmart responded, Chinless Mitch, by shutting down every meat-cutting operation in every Walmart in the United States of America? What about them? They wanted to pay the dues. What about them, Chinless Mitch? Of course, this genius thinks that employee free choice will Europeanize America. Really? We're going to have nice cheese trays coming around after dinner and maybe stop being quite so obese, and we'll take seriously environmental issues like mountaintop removal. Is that what you mean by Europeanize America? No, I mean it'll make us all socialist commies. Europeanize America? We'll be walking around talking to that French, or maybe Spanish, or German, or Italian, or something. Not the English that God Almighty wants the whole world to talk, because God speaks English, you know. According to an AFL-CIO survey, 60 million Americans who go to work every day say that they would join a union if only they could. Now, why can't they? I mean, after all, the freedom of association, which it would theoretically at least include organizing into collective bargaining units, otherwise known as union locals, that would seem to be a part of the First Amendment, wouldn't it? In 57% of union organizing drives in this country, where people band together and try to form a collective bargaining unit, a company says, well, y'all can have your union, but if you do, we're going to close the plant. Whether they intend to or not, they simply threaten it. And to folks who are living paycheck to paycheck and 2 weeks away from utter ruin, as so many millions upon millions of Americans are, that threat to close the plant carries a lot of weight. In 47% of organizing efforts, the company threatens to cut wages and benefits of working people if they join a union. And the most terrifying of all outcomes, 34% of the time when a union attempts to organize, the company fires the workers who were in favor of that union. Interestingly, all three of those things, threatening to close plants, threatening to cut wages and benefits, and firing pro-union workers, all of those are patently illegal under the National Labor Relations Act. But they get away with it. God knows, for the 8 long, tortured, tormented, agonizing years that were the George W. Pinhead administration, they got away with it. With Elaine Chao, Merkin for chinless Mitch McConnell, at the helm of the Department of Labor, the Department of Labor became literally a bureaucratic agency in which injustices and claims of injustices went to die. So if a non-union coal miner said, "Boss, that hole ain't safe, I ain't going in," boss can say, "Well, son, pack your stuff up and don't ever plan on mining coal anywhere around here ever again because we know your name." That would be illegal. The company would get away with it. And the family of the worker might well starve. When the manager at Walmart says, "Now, son, go out there and clock out and then come back in and unload this your truck," the worker can't say, "No, you pay me for my time, or I'm going home." Because the manager can fire him on the spot, and there is no justice, because for those 8 years, Elaine Chao turned the Department of Labor into a place where wage and hour claims went to die. You know, when I do not mean to diminish this by any degree, but when a police officer or a firefighter is killed in the line of duty, there is a big to-do with the funeral. The fire trucks or police cars are draped in black bunting and form a cortege. Taps is blown. Perhaps another name is chiseled into a memorial for the fallen officer, the fallen firefighter. But no such thing happens when a worker dies. Because that's all we are. We're just workers. We're ciphers. We can be replaced. There's somebody else waiting to do the job that one of us was no longer able to do. And Labor Day means so much more. I mean, yeah, we're going to barbecue. We're going to have us some pulled pork, maybe some ribs this weekend. The holiday that ends summer. The holiday that says downhill to freezing your ass off. But the holiday that also marks the nobility of work. And it is the one holiday we have in which we can remember those who die in their thousands every year, doing nothing more than trying to take care of their families and contribute to their communities. That's Labor Day. The New York Times reporting on September the 1st on a study that is out. It is the most comprehensive examination of wage law violations in a decade. One of the studies authors is Ruth Milkman. She's a sociology professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, otherwise known as UCLA. $4,387 workers were surveyed in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. And they were surveyed particularly in low-wage industries like the garment business, child care, discount retailing, otherwise known as Wally World, Kmart, etc. On average, the study found that the typical worker had lost $51 the previous week. Week. As a result of wage violations. And that was $51 on average weekly earnings of $339. For a family making $339 a week, that extra 51 means a hell of a lot. The difference between 390 a week and 339 can be the difference between having one's water on or cut off. These workers are often cheated and paid less than the minimum wage. The cheating translates to a 15% loss in pay. And the most one of the most horrifying things to arise out of the study is how successful the employers. Remember those enlightened employers that chinless Mitch McConnell was talking about? One of the most sad things is how easily they get away with it. Because low-wage workers are terrified workers. Low-wage workers are terrorized workers. They are desperate by design. And the employers know it. It is broad, this abuse. It is across the board, this abuse. And it is institutional. Among the greatest horrors, if you can imagine. Imagine this. We talked about how it was organized labor who led to the creation of workers' compensation so that a family wouldn't be utterly destroyed because daddy got hurt on the job or mama got hurt on the job. This is one of those that comes out of the study that just makes the little hairs stand up on the back of your neck. Only 8% of the people surveyed who suffered serious injuries on the job. Filed for workers' comp. Workers' comp to which they were entitled. Workers' comp which was theirs by right. But for which the employer often says, well, you know, you can file a comp claim. That's your right. See that poster? We have to hang it on the wall. Government says we got to hang it on the wall. If you get hurt, you can file comp. You're free to do it. bear in mind, you know, I'm just saying, your job might not be here when you get back. We got work's got to be done here, son. Now, darling, I know that cut's bleeding like you're going to bleed out. But let's just go back to the break room and bandage it up. You don't need to file a comp claim, honey. Really? Only 8% of those who suffered serious injuries on the job made a comp claim. That means in a country with an already broken health care system, those working people bore the cost of their own medical treatment. Because, of course, another one of those pernicious effects of for-profit health care is the fact that for-profit health care will tell you, no, we don't cover for work-related injuries. That's comp. So that average worker making that $339 a week took it on the chin to get that cut stitched up and didn't get paid for the day or so they had to lay off work. And that applies to 92 out of 100 people in that circumstance. 92% didn't file workers' compensation. We don't need the Employment Free Choice Act because we got enlightened employers. Not AFL-CIO. They just won't raise their membership up. That's all. Their numbers is down. They ain't making the money they used to make off them dues. That's all the reason they want that EFCA for. You think it's limited to class or race? Mm-mm. No. Among those surveyed, among the 4,387 workers surveyed, 39% were undocumented immigrants, 31% were documented immigrants, and 30% were born right here in the U.S. of A., by God. Workers get cheated out of their hourly pay. They get cheated out of the minimum wage. And 76% of the survey group also got cheated out of overtime. Again, all of those are illegal. The study is called Broken Laws, Unprotected Workers. You might want to look it up. And when we talk about cheating somebody out of minimum wage, we're talking about being cheated out of no more than $7.15 an hour in New York State, $7.50 an hour in Illinois, and $8 in California. Oh, and by the way, if you're female, it is much more likely that you're going to get cheated than if you're male. If you are female and an undocumented immigrant, it is almost a certainty. Then amongst those, that 30% born right here in the U.S. of A., if you are of African-American extraction descent, if your skin ain't pink, you are three times as likely as the white guy. To get ripped off by your boss. The Secretary of Labor now under President Obama is Hilda Solis. She said in an email statement to the New York Times, quoting, "There's no excuse for the disregard of federal labor standards, especially those designed to protect the neediest among us." Today's report clearly shows we still have a major task before us. You see, because one of those things that Elaine Chao was very good at was something that most Republicans in government are very good at, see FEMA, and that is doing the Grover Norquist drown it in a bathtub thing to the agency of, over which they have oversight. Hilda Solis came into her position and found herself needing to hire 250 wage and hour investigators. I would warrant that she could probably use 1,750 more beyond that and still have her staff of investigators significantly overworked. That is by design. Not Hilda Solis's design, but the crippling effect that 8 years tormented, anguished, ripped off years of the Bush administration had on what it means to be a worker in the United States of America. We're talking about thieving here. That 51 bucks an hour, or that 51 bucks a week that I mentioned a moment ago, if that same working person went out and stole $51 out of the purse of the boss, there are states in which that person could be charged with a felony and sent to prison for years. At the very least, that $51 would qualify as petit larceny. And in states like West Virginia, subject the person doing the thieving to up to a year in the county jail and a massive fine and restitution and court costs. Yeah. So we have that to think about this upcoming Labor Day weekend. If you do, similar to what we will do here, and you barbecue or some such, then by all means, take a minute and think of those that make this country go. Because you know what? The CEO of Goldman Sachs doesn't make this country go. The president of GE doesn't make this country go. No. Not even a little bit. The people who make this country go are the $339 a week wage slave down to the Wally World, or working in a restaurant. Or working in a yard. Or a nursing home. That's who makes this country go. And they die on the job and they don't file comp claims. And they get butchered on the job and they don't file comp claims. And in the sick, psychotic, sociopathic, twisted minds of right-wingers like Mitch McConnell, they ain't got nothing. They ain't got nothing coming to them. It is, of course, Friday on the front porch, and it is a beautiful afternoon here in the hills and hollers of Appalachia. Come on up on the porch. Grab a swig out of the jug. Get yourself a cold glass of sweet iced tea. Lemon or no lemon, it's your choice. Let's cogitate and cuss and discuss a little bit. And by the way, a very happy birthday this Labor Day weekend. A very happy birthday to Boss Man Wayne. Now there's something fitting. A man who has done so much in his life to advance the cause of working folks. And he shares a birthday with the holiday that honors working folks. Happy birthday, Wayne. Jump into the conversation. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. You can dial direct at 304-658-3333. Email comes in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. We are, of course, America's listener-supported liberal voice, which pretty much means that the horn is, in fact, a voice that is kept going by working people. People who do work and people who have worked and people who understand the value and the nobility of that work. Man. I don't know about you, but that just inspires me to the little hairs stand up on the back of my neck. It does. And we'll be back. Light them up if you want to. This is the horn.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20-odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. And you think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile as you kill. You want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
You know, I meant that as kind of a tribute, but I'm probably going to get a call from Reverbo now telling me these. Hey, Bob, you're not. You done it again, Bob. Sorry, didn't mean to be such a downer. Tough song. Really tough song, but a brilliant piece of work by the late, great John Lennon. And so much truth in it. But, don't despair. There's 2.5 hours of conversation left. Somebody can save this program. Hey, Sandra, can you save the program?
No, you know it ain't going to be me.
What
the hell? Hey, listen, no, though, just call because those statistics, you know, it's just, it's wrenching. The, you know, $300 a week majority of us, you know, and you're really just on your effing own. It's just sick.
Yeah, don't get sick. Don't get hurt. And, don't have your car break down. Don't have your refrigerator go out. Don't let your utilities get turned off. Any one of those things can literally kill a family.
I know, it's incredible. And the idea that it's just the vast majority of people in this country, I can't even begin to understand the separation that's going on between our so-called media and everything else. You know, it's just, there's no connection at all, because this term, this jobless recovery bullshit, is a horror term in economics. Give me an effing break. And it's just a slap in the face, because no job in this country, there is no recovery for those people and us you're talking about, the majority. None of this gibberish makes any sense if you don't have job recovery. And the Obama administration, shame on them for their trying to describe this less of a free fall as a recovery now. Give me a break.
You know that the only cable news that I get is Fox, right?
Oh, no, I didn't know you were in that bit of purgatory. What?
Oh, yeah, it's tough. I mean, I can take it in little bitty doses.
Sure.
And I saw, I turned it on. I did. Until, you know, as Malloy says, until my brain started leaking out my ears. But they had some right-wing congressman on there who was screaming, well, you know, the stimulus is a failure, and that Neil Cavuto creep was on there at the time. And the funny thing is they won't identify people as Republicans when they come on. They had the governor of Rhode Island, who I guess has problems similar to the governor of California at this point, only much smaller in geographic space. I don't know if the guy was a Democrat or a Republican, but he had apparently gone head to head and tried to shut down state government for a couple of days a week.
Yeah, and
the Supreme Court said, and Supreme Court of Rhode Island said, you can't do that.
No, this is Rhode Island. Rhode Island is the reason why we got the Constitution and we're not in the, just states, you know, Articles of Confederation. So, I don't know. You know, the people there don't really mess around. So it's interesting to see that play out.
Oh, and he says, I'm not just taking on the union. Well, we've got a heavily unionized state workforce, and they're the ones who brought this. And sitting there, laying it out against unions on Labor Day weekend, and I'm sitting here thinking, Jesus, can we put just a black, how the FDA black boxes drugs, and they put that black box warning around drugs? That are dangerous, dangerous, dangerous. Can we just get a black border put around Fox? You know, warning, this is total BS and is dangerous to your cognitive abilities.
No, it's definitely dangerous, you know, along with all the maneuvering that's going on about the economy, because it was like 250,000 jobs, you know, in their so-called job report. And we're supposed to be sitting here listening to them spin it as a positive? Please. Please, and the recession being over because, the economic indicator says that there's you know, a point, 0.1.
Right, and we went from $700,000 or 700,000 jobs lost a month to 200,000 jobs lost a month. And I'm just paranoid enough, Sandra. I am just paranoid enough for that little pain in the ass that lives in the back of my brain to say, well, maybe we're not losing 700,000 a month because we don't have 700,000 a month to lose anymore.
Well, yeah, no, that is something you can factor in. But more disturbing to me is I don't hear any chit chat about the 500,000 or more who are not going to have any unemployment benefit. It's exhausted at the end of the month. Have you heard any more discussion about what's going to happen to those people, Bob?
No, because I think they're largely forgotten.
Okay, but those, you know, that's a sizable.
And those people will then become, what's the phrase, disillusioned or discouraged workers, and they won't be unemployed anymore, Sandra.
So, that's what I'm saying. That's why when you look at this 200, 300, as it dwindles down to, you know, their recovery, just keep in mind that you're still getting 600,000 people a week applying for what little benefits there are. So, you know.
Man, make the pie higher.
No, the number is you know, I'm sure it's eased off, but I'm scared they're going to use the easing off as an excuse to not introduce some more extensions. You see, so we're getting to that Mad Max portion of 2009, because what are you supposed to do? There's no safety net, and what little they had, this little 200 a week you got, is now gone, and people don't starve easily. So I'm just wondering, you know, what do you think they're going to do? Just walk away quietly and die somewhere? Is that what they think is going to happen?
Yeah, well, you know, it's that line about statistics, you know. If they're not countable, they're not on there, and if they're not on there, they're not a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very cynical of me, but you know, I'm not a born cynic. I wasn't born this way. I'm what happens to idealists when reality hits them in the head, Sandra.
Well, yeah, but you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if you know, wasn't a hopeful person, Bob. I mean, I don't mean to make assumptions, but you'll let me say that, right?
Oh, yeah, I mean.
But, you know, we can only go so far with the Pollyanna stuff. I'm done with it, and I don't know. I don't even know what to say about these.
Well, I'm sick of these Republicans saying, well, you know, the stimulus hasn't worked because they've only got $85 million or $85 billion or whatever the millions, billions, whatever. 10% of the money's out. I heard that said today, and I thought, wait a minute. Has my world gone completely sideways? Did I just hear a Republican complaining that a Democrat isn't spending money fast enough?
They're completely useless. I mean, it's just sort of never-ending what's going on. I have to say, maybe you can help me out with this, but this whole attack on Obama because he's talking to some kids, what is that about?
I don't know. I got several emails here. And apparently I'm going to have to find out if it's going to be in my kids' schools, because this is a suggestion that Michael from Kid A in the chat room, who's from Columbus, said, you know, if your kid is going to a school where they're not going to play it, tell them you're keeping your kid home and you're going to show it to them at home and you demand in-school credit for it.
So when did the country become a parliament? System, because I thought the president was independently elected in a federal, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, oh yeah, I do.
What's going on? Okay, so now all of a sudden the executive of this country isn't an autonomous, popularly elected official. He's a part of, you know what I'm saying? It's stunning to look at the mentality. It's like, I thought this level of, this is our president, right?
Right, and when did a presidential? I don't recall any popular referendums in little lily white school districts about George Bush.
Well, that's what I'm saying, or his father and other presidents who do this routinely. This is stuff that the figurehead portion of the president, the The one that wears the...
Yeah, this is the warm and the fuzzy with the handshakes and the, you know... Yes!
Right, there's many hats that the executive wears, you know, and it's just sort of like... I mean, this is just stunning to look at. I don't even, you know, it's scary. It really is, because they're really trying to turn Obama, you know, into not viable as an executive. It's the polar opposite of Bush, if you know what I mean? It's unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it.
And of course, where this is coming from, you know, Michael reporting that there are three schools around where he lives that, no, they're not going to show the president's address. And the stuff that's flown out of the right-wing hate machine over this, I mean, have you seen some of the things that have been said?
You mean about this upcoming chit-chat?
Yeah. That he's trying to indoctrinate the children of this country. I mean, these people are fast approaching Jack D. Ripper status, you know, from Dr. Strangelove. They're completely nuts.
It's unbelievable, but it just goes back to this whole, like, that balkanization thing that we were talking about the last time I called. I mean, and progressives are, once again, you know, the response isn't really happening, but I understand we don't have much of a bullhorn, but this is kind of getting out of control.
More than. I can't. This stuff just blows my mind. The topic of this speech is persisting and succeeding in school.
Yeah, no, it's real generic. I mean, the man is just talking about what?
But remember when they rode Michelle?
Yeah.
For talking to those girls in school?
Right.
And talking about, you know, how she spoke. And I thought, you know, they were going to come completely unglued over that. And they did. And this is more of the same. Well, you know, we can't have that one talking to the children. Let's see. Yeah, he's going to indoctrinate children. And this from the life support system for a haircut, Sean Hannity. It seems very close to indoctrination. And then there's Monica Crowley, you know, the attack blonde.
Oh, God, yeah.
Just when you think this administration can't get any more surreal and Orwellian, here they come to indoctrinate our kids. And then there's Michelle Malkin.
The
left has always used kids in public schools as guinea pigs and as junior lobbyists for their social liberal agenda. What? I mean, are they reading the same news I am? Because, you know, Wednesday night I opened the program with the story of a Missouri high school that seized T-shirts because they had silhouettes of little monkeys that turn into a man on them. That's a liberal social agenda? You know, somebody get me Michelle Malkin real quick.
Wow, that's incredible.
For the band, Sandra, for the band. And all the little monkeys were holding horns. And not only were they told not to wear them in school, they were seized because a woman who teaches in that school district who has a kid in that band said, I really don't think Smith Cotton High School needs to be associated with evolution.
Smith Cotton High School?
Smith Cotton High School.
Oh, God. No, I really sometimes don't think I'm of this country because I don't know who those people are. I don't understand. And it's just disturbing. Is he still giving the speech, though?
Thank God they haven't knuckled under on this one.
Okay, because, you know, that's my next question with these people. You know, we seem to kowtow with just a little outrage from these freaks, and then they're changing their whole plan.
Well, you know, I'm still waiting for Rahm Emanuel to come out and say that the president will give a speech to school children, but there won't be any school children. Necessarily. You know, the same way he's done with the public option. I don't know.
Yeah, well, and, you know, the other subject I wanted to mention.
Oh, on the speech thing, they're also saying that it's just like what Chairman Mao did.
Yeah, no, I heard that association. I just sort of thought, good night.
But I'm sorry, I cut you off.
The other subject that's doing my head in is this freak, Gates. You know how I feel about him. His carryover from the Bush administration is almost like a conspiracy to me. I can't deal with it. This fool coming out lambasting the AP for showing what war really is. I'm so sick of that. I'm so sick of this country, you know, not explaining what the hell it's doing to the population. I can't stand it.
Yeah, because if what you're doing is open and above board, why can't you show it?
No, this isn't. Last time I heard, this isn't an autocratic country. So, okay, I'm just saying. So, we the people should see what the hell is going on. That's how you.
Well, otherwise we're not we. Otherwise we're not we the people. We're we the subjects.
No, and that's what I think is going on. When you see media after media group backing down and saying like they're not going to show the picture now because Gates came out, you know, with the long arm of the state to tell them what's what. That's scary to me too. And the people, you know, it's like this war. They're also talking about increasing troops. Oh, yeah, we think that's a good idea, I read today.
Yeah, if we just send a few more thousand Marines, then the Taliban will just look, oh, well, they're sending more Marines, we quit.
But at the same time, we have to shut down any look-see for Americans to see the death and dying and maiming that's going on. I mean, it's stunning, and, you know, for Obama to let his administration get bogged down in his own personal war for the sake of what? Being a wartime president?
No, I think he wants to be the guy who got it right.
But they all want that, from Alexander to now. I mean, come on.
And nobody has.
Well, no one has, but it's just sort of, I can't believe he's, I don't know. I really, like I said, I have issues because of the Gates. He didn't get his own person in there, so I'm trying to figure out what's kind of going on, because it's not like it's Obama's Secretary of Defense.
See, I keep getting this notion that somebody's gone to President Obama and said, listen, you see how these wing nuts are behaving? If you try to bring people home from Afghanistan and save these soldiers' lives, they're going to get even crazier. You thought they were crazy. Now wait till they start saying you surrendered to the Taliban, and that's when he looks at me. Oh, can't do that.
Well, no.
I mean, is that unreasonable? I mean, is that the kind of political calculus that the president would undertake?
Yeah, but it's the kind of calculus that I don't know, because I think that there's more powerful interest involved in maintaining the endless war. Now that they got it after 9/11, it's not going to go away. It really is like Eurasia and Oceania now. And I just think you just plug in a president and the policy goes on, you know, which is the realist aspect of world politics. But in this case, it seems to be Bush, Obama, Palin. We would still be in this situation. Maybe I'm wrong, but
I got to think that if it was McCain, it would be worse.
Okay, we can think it could be worse. Yeah, but don't forget, it's the seamless, you know, the seamless transfer from Gates to Gates.
Yeah, I guess that guy had a job either way.
Right, and because he's in charge of the Pentagon, which is, you know, this sort of bloated bureaucracy, yeah, you would think that the executives would want to have his own fingerprints on that. See, that's my thing. I think that there's something really wrong there, because it's never happened before. Never.
Did the Gates thing happen at the same time they were catching all the hell for all the people that had tax problems?
No, this was something that, you know, just sort of, there was a few outcries about, oh, no, he needs to replace them. And then they said Gates, you know, he said, oh, he's going to keep him there for a year. Remember that, a year, and then, you know, reevaluate. Now, how much you want to bet there ain't going to be no reevaluation?
I won't take the bet.
Okay, but the thing is, and I know this is sort of, you know, that might be really boring, but I do think people should really think about that. Truman appointed the first Secretary of Defense, you know, with the creation of a national security state, and this is the first time never had a holdover from different parties, you see?
Yeah.
Not within the party. We've had changes, of course. Democrat to Democrat, but from Democrat to Republican to Democrat and vice versa.
And I guess that all falls under that rubric of being post-political.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's post-bullshit.
Yeah, right, which was exactly what I was going to, yeah, post this.
Yeah, but it's just, and it's a big, I just think it's a really big deal when you look at what's going on with the endless war, because we were told that there was going to be a wind down in Iraq. Has that happened?
Maybe a little bit, but any wind down in Iraq has been transferred to Afghanistan.
Yeah, anyway,
I mean, we're being told, well, you know, they're coming home soon, they're going to be home in 2010, oh, they'll be home in 2011.
Just like we're being told that there'll be a public option in what year? 2013?
13? Yeah.
Yeah, anyway, listen, have a good, Labor Day, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, you take care, Sandra, and you got class Tuesday morning?
I do, yeah.
Oh, God.
It is kind of...
You know, one of these days you got to email me your syllabus.
Oh, yeah, I'll send you something.
I appreciate it.
All right, bye.
See ya. Bye now. Professor Sandra from California. And she's right about Robert Gates. You know, he was quietly, well, you know, this certainly is post-partisan. But it's also unheralded and unprecedented. Unprecedented. Has not been done before. And how much difference is there between the Bush administration in Afghanistan and the Obama administration in Afghanistan? They're both still in Afghanistan. Wedding parties are still getting rocketed. It's a fair question. And as Democrats, liberals, progressives, whatever one calls oneself, I don't think it is unfair to ask for a level of accountability on an issue of such gravity. Let's go on to back to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey.
Sparky from California.
Hey, Sparky, what's up, man?
Hey, I thought I'd call since you're talking about labor and unions and Labor Day.
Great, I'm glad you did.
Stimulus projects.
Yeah.
You know, I went to work on one. A recovery project for the EPA up here.
Right, right.
And I just wanted people to think. I mean, there's guys in construction that are working on these projects all over the...
Right, they are happening. They are happening, without a doubt.
Working if it wasn't for that.
And I imagine that's made a significant difference in your world, hasn't it?
Yeah, I know all the young guys that work for the company I've been working for that put me back to work. They kept working all this time, but they ran out of anything to do, and the only thing they had was this project up there at Spring Creek for this EPA, you know, to clean up the copper mine stuff. And otherwise, nobody'd be working. There's several hundred people working on this project. So there's no jobless recoveries. I mean, like they say, there's people that would have been unemployed that are working right now.
That is very much true, Sparky. The thing is, though, I mean, it's being described as a jobless recovery because, well, for one, you've got the right wing out there who is saying without fail, what was the thing I heard today? The stimulus is a failure. There's another Newt Gingrich or one of those godforsaken bastards said the stimulus government has not created a job yet. Well, you're living proof of the lie on that, aren't you?
Yep.
I mean, was some private company out there gonna do that cleanup? No, I don't think so.
That's what's going to happen in West Virginia eventually. The government's going to get stuck with the cleanup.
Oh, I know we are. And you know, I've mentioned that fact to a number of people, and it's upsetting to some of my friends who say, you know, make the coal companies do it. Well, that's a lovely sentiment, but the coal companies aren't going to do it. By the time that it needs doing, properly doing, they're going to be a million light years away from here.
what happened here. They stopped mining copper in the middle 50s, and they just walked away. And then they sold the property to somebody else, and then sold it to somebody else, and then, like, the government went to them and says, you got to clean this up. And they go, well, we just own the property. We didn't cause the problem. Well, what are we going to do here, folks?
Well, we're just going to let it sit there and be poisonous.
Blown off a mountain that comes out of these damn copper mines, it gets into this big old ugly-looking red brownish lake, and then in the wintertime it overflows and it goes into the Sacramento River, and to combat it, they had to release more water from Shasta Dam every winter to flush the pollutants down the river, and it goes all the way out to San Francisco Bay and onto the ocean. So,
better to stop it at the source, right?
Yeah. So in the 90s, they built the treatment plant up the hill, and now they're trying to clean up what they're trying to do is clean up the old reservoir where all the silt and shit is sunk to the bottom. They're going to suck it out, pump it up to this treatment area, and then put it in this big hole they've dug in the ground. It's all lined with stuff that supposedly won't do deep into the water system again. Pump all that stuff in there and then bury it. And 2 years from now, everything we did will be ripped out. All the electrical panels, the controllers, the power lines, everything will be gone.
How long is the job supposed to last, Sparky?
Well, it's still in the middle of October or sometime then. But, you know, better than nothing.
Shoot, yeah. And of course, and that's through, and you're off the bench then with your local, right?
Yeah, I have to sign the books again when I come in.
But you know what? Be it what you said, you know, it's good. It's good to have what you got going.
Yeah, because it was 8 months of nothing.
And just out of curiosity, how many people are on that job, if you know?
Just from what I read, there was supposed to be like 300. There's people that I see every day that I haven't seen the next day. I mean, there's people everywhere. I mean, there's like 40 people at our safety meeting every morning. We have a safety meeting. We have to go over the scope of work, where you're going to be working, because we have real tight roadways, and you got to tell people that you're going to be working here. You're going to have a road closure, or you got to schedule all this stuff, and you got to have confined space clearances to work in certain areas. They're putting in these big silos that contain the chemicals they're going to use at site one, and we can't get in the silos yet to do all our work. We got control panels and motors to hook up in there, and all kinds of things to do. And we can't get in there because they don't have the confined space sniffing equipment yet. And every day, because all there is paint fumes in there now, but it could affect you and you could pass out, but it's like triple safety, everything. You know, you have to have steel-toed shoes, you have to have your PPE, your personal protection equipment, wear gloves, no hard hats, safety glasses, all that stuff. And it just, sometimes you think, well, you can't get anything done because you have to do all the safety stuff to get it done and get okays to do this and that, but that's just the way it is in the world. And everybody on that project has to have gone through an OSHA 30 class, which is 30 hours of instruction on safety measures and hazards of the construction workplace. It's quite involved.
Yeah, and when you consider those numbers from that article I had in the first part of the program, you know, only 8% of injured low wage workers filing a comp claim. Suddenly, that safety class then makes a little bit more sense, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And you're on the clock for it too, right?
Yep, you're paid from the time you show up until the time you leave.
And that's the way it ought to be.
Work, you have to pay, fill out, you get paid for it. But I know what it's like being a former organizer. I was an organizer from 94 to 97 here when we had our own local in Redding before we got merged with Sacramento. And it's a hard job to go out there and talk to people and then to explain their rights to them and then their workers' comp rights and just even I had this one non-union shop that the guys were complaining to me, well, our employer has started a 401k program for us. And I said, do you get a statement every year? And they said, well, no. Well, how do you know he's putting money into it?
He said he was.
And I said, you better start demanding it through ERISA. You have to, just like you get a Social Security statement and every year now or every 2 years, it's part of the law. But they didn't know that. So they didn't know. All they knew is that he was putting money into a 401k program. And I said, well, do you know how much in it? No. Well, why not? We don't know. And I said, well, time to find out. So I called his employer, too, and I demanded he get him a statement. And lit a fire on him, and they had him within a week.
Wow. And was it real?
Yeah, it was real. He had once he gets the statements, that money's got to be there.
Or else there's Club Fed problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different labor department then, but the last 8 years, you went through it. It was the worst it's ever been.
Oh, Elaine Chao was a walking, talking, breathing nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't tell you the number of people that I've talked to over the years who said, yeah. I remember being in D.C. in September of, oh, God, what was it, September of 07, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And folks from a newspaper, newspaper production folks, who had really, really compelling, legitimate, massive fair labor claims. And, I mean, I can't remember what the exact number was in the first 4 years of the Bush administration. I think the National Labor Relations Board issued maybe four decisions, tops.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they just stopped working. Because all of those career civil servants were told, do you really want, no, just stop working, take it easy. You know, shuffle papers for 4-8 years, whatever.
We had the same thing happen here back when Pete Wilson was our governor, before Gray Davis.
Yeah.
The Labor Department just kind of shut down and wouldn't do nothing, and then we were fighting Pete Wilson on prevailing wage laws. He was trying to get those changed. We had a big rally, march on Sacramento and march on L.A. There was 10,000 union construction workers marched on Sacramento, Valentine's Day, 1996, and it was called the Have a Heart Rally. Pete Wilson, you know, he was trying to eliminate prevailing wage laws in the state, and in L.A., the same day, there was 25,000 people marched. And what's the labor secretary? Hilda Solis.
Yeah.
Was a speaker. She was in the state assembly or senate then. She was at the rally and was a speaker at the Capitol then before she became a congressman. She went through the assembly, the state senate, and has always been a friend of labor, and then she went to Congress. She's fought for, you know, her folks were all, the Teamsters, I think. So she's been, grew up in a labor family.
Well, I think she's a good choice. But she came into the office, as I know, you know, she said she's hiring 250 new wage and hour investigators.
Mm-hmm.
that's because they were needed, not because the Department of Labor in its enforcement division was gutted, Sparky, gutted.
Mm-hmm. Well, what we've had to do in California, most of the IBEW and construction unions have had to go out and hire their own labor compliance officers for prevailing wage monitoring and stuff because the state doesn't have enough people to watch it. So what they do is they go to job pre-bids and pass out their business cards and tell them that they're like, they call them labor compliance officers. The awarding body can have a labor compliance officer too, but we've taken it upon ourselves. And I think we have, in our local, we have two that work the northern part of the state here. For every state federal project, they go out there and they, for any non-union contractor that works in these, here's the labor laws you better be following, and we're going to be watching. And you need to submit your certified payrolls on time and everything to the awarding body, because we're going to be requesting them, because the public can go out and ask for this stuff, because it's all supposed to be open and above board, public information. But that's what we've had to do out here in California.
And it was
keeping people honest.
Look, you know, the relentless onslaught against things like prevailing wage is epidemic countrywide. You know, the organized West Virginia's still got, you know, a decent number of union members in it, and has grown when other states were losing union members. But they have to fight day in and day out to preserve prevailing wage, which is little more than a statement that if we're going to spend taxpayer dollars to build taxpayer-funded buildings, we're not going to do it on the cheap and expect people to grovel for the work. Now, but it's well, I mentioned the boss, Wayne. He has a never-ending struggle to get local city governments, county governments, and so forth, and to simply obey the law and pay prevailing wage on prevailing wage jobs. Because, and I'm sure California is similar, you got Davis-Bacon on the federal level, which is federal prevailing wage, but then West Virginia has its own state prevailing wage law. Because if it's not a federal project, then Davis-Bacon doesn't necessarily apply. And that's what they, well, you know, it's in federal money. Well, but it's state money.
Mini Davis-Bacon law, the state.
Yeah, the state.
California Davis-Bacon law.
Right, and West Virginia has one too, and a lot of other states as well. I mean, dear God, you know, we're sitting here this week remembering the fourth anniversary of the devastation of the Gulf Coast and New Orleans. Do you remember, Sparky, do you remember what George Bush did, one of the first things he did after Katrina?
Wanted to get rid of prevailing wage and
right. He
got rid of project labor agreements too.
Well, yeah, he some federal money was dedicated to doing some cleanup and rebuilding work, and at the stroke of a pen, he declared that it would not be prevailing wage work.
Mm-hmm.
And there was enough of an outcry raised about that that he had to go back and undo it. That was one of the few times that he was forced to back down. But imagine that people you know died in that disaster. And to ask people to go in and work on the cleanup and have it not be prevailing wage, you know, what kind of monstrous mindset is involved in that? What kind of sickness? I don't know. Rhetorical question, of course. That doesn't call for an answer from you, but we know what we're up against.
All I know is one of the first things Obama did was rescind the order, executive order that Bush had on project labor agreement on federal project.
Right.
That was one of the...
Yeah, so that a PLA would be mandatory again.
Well, they can use it, or they don't have to use it, I don't think.
Yeah, but it's available as opposed to forbidden.
Yeah. Because what we did here back in the early 2000s, when we were building all the power plants, we had all the unions got together and they put a campaign together and they called it Cure Californians for Reliable Energy. And all the power plants, they pulled our money and we sicked all the lawyers on all these companies that were going to build the power plant. If you didn't follow the environmental rules and regulations and stuff, and then we made it so that they wanted to sign project labor agreement. So most of the power plants that were built during that energy crisis in the early 2000 were all union. I worked on one that was with Bechtel. And we've got one going right now. This outfit out of Minnesota's building, about 85 miles south of Redding, Gemma, and it's for Pacific Graph and Extortion, of course. Another gas-powered plant. And now they're trying to get all the solar power plants that are going to be built in Southern California, they're trying to get those all under Project Lemur agreements, too. Because those are really getting big down there. In San Diego, the local in San Diego even built a training center in Imperial Valley because they figure that's going to be one of the big centers for solar energy in the country, but down there. And I mean, they're going to build massive amounts of power plants, you know, in the desert area and stuff. So the IBEW is working a lot on renewable energy. As I talked to John a couple of Sunday nights about.
Yeah, I heard your conversation the other night, and it was a dandy. Well, I can't imagine doing renewable, clean, green electricity and power in this country without organized labor, because frankly, so much of the expertise that has to do with that resides inside union locals,
mm-hmm.
and also, you know, from the overarching national downward, they're the ones that do the trainings, they're the ones that do the teachings, they're the ones that do the certification.
Yeah, well, we have our own national training. Well, it's not a center, but it's called the NJTA, National Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee. And we used to have the summer training sessions for instructors at the University of Tennessee. But now they moved out of Tennessee and they're in Michigan now. So that's where they train the instructors in the summer. And each IBEW local has its own training center where they train the people, and they have standardized training material that comes from the international. You got to buy it from the NJTC book, but they're all the same. So everybody in the country is getting the same training.
And you know, that's where that's concerned. That kind of standardization is, I think, beneficial. Because, you know, you've got, as the saying goes, everybody on the same page.
Yes, and especially applies to linemen, too, because they have to travel all over the country in emergencies. They call in people, you know, when they have ice storms and the power lines go down. They get people from all over the country, and most of those are all IBEW crews that travel around the country when needed to be to repair the, you know, in the hurricanes or whatever happens. They can't just whip those people out of thin air. They got to call them from other parts of the country.
Oh, I've seen them travel. I've seen folks those traveling crews around here after ice storms,
mm-hmm.
And they are. They're from all over. Well, Sparky, I really appreciate you calling in, and glad I am. I mean, just on a personal level, you know, glad I am that. That you've got that gig with that necessary. And that's the thing. This is not some frivolous project. This is a project you're working on that was left lie because the wholly private sector wasn't willing to do the work. So, you know, I'm glad it was there, and I'm glad you're doing it.
Yeah, and it affected the salmon runs. It affected the, you know, we make so much hydroelectric power here, affects the amount of water they have to release, and they can't control the water flow. They have to release more water than they use to generate power. So they're expecting to get more power out of it. I went into the powerhouse the other day, and I've never been into a hydro powerhouse. It's pretty quiet in there. But on the outside, where the water comes out, it makes a real river, whitewater river noise, you know. But inside the plant, the generators just hum along.
Yeah, it's that quiet that quiet hum. Uh-huh. As school kids, we used to go. We would get a field trip in the spring down to the bottom of Wilson Dam,
mm-hmm.
in northwest Alabama, and you know, all those, and just, exactly.
And no pollution.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Sparky, have yourself a good Labor Day weekend.
And I didn't work the picnic, but it's the labor of love. I posted some pictures earlier on the chat room.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, good luck to you, and enjoy it, and, you know, thanks for being part of what makes the working class, or gives the working class what little clout it has left. Thank you.
Yeah, I work at it every day. Thanks, Bob.
All right, you take care, Sparky.
Okay, talk to you later.
All right, bye now.
Bye.
Calling from California. Good union man, IBEW man. That's Sparky. And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Well, hey, David, how are you?
Well, I want to say this right now. I can't be on a team of people who keep apologizing. Did you see what the latest with Van Jones?
No.
This guy falls for Glenn Beck, for God's sakes.
No. I don't know if I can take it. I don't have the liquor bottle out. Don't tell me Van Jones apologized to Glenn Beck.
He didn't apologize to Glenn Beck, but he apologized because of an action that Glenn Beck took. His name was on a 9/11 truther list a few years ago. And at first they said, what happens is usually those lists, he had nothing to do with it and blah, blah, blah. And, finally, he saw that the heat was coming on for Glenn and his in shock board of insanity. And he apologized. Every time we apologize.
We make them a little bit stronger.
We make them a little bit stronger. And also, we chip away at our progression. And we become degressive. That's not being progressive. See, what you have to do...
Yeah, that's regressive.
What you have to do is you have to say it like this, Bob. You say, I understand people may have a problem with what I believe in, but I believe in strongly with my convictions, and I don't see why we can't do that in America. And that's what we need to start doing. And there might be some outrage at first, but after a while, people will start to respect you. And they'll say, I don't agree with this person, but he's actually not apologizing. And it might not be the right-wingers, but it'll be the centerists. Because the centerists think we're pussies now, people. Just want to put that out. And they're right.
Or weak-kneed, or weak-willed, or, yes.
I did want to say, I did want to move this along, because I know you probably have other callers. I wanted to ask, did you know who lives in West Virginia that you may need to do a interview with shortly? Because time is running out for this person.
Who's that?
Bill Withers. He lives in West Virginia.
Oh, yes, he does. Yes, he does.
And there's a documentary out. I think he lives in Forkham, West Virginia, or something to that effect. I may have the town wrong. So forgive me, people, if I scarred your town in any way, insulted it by saying it wrong. Is there a place called Forkham? I don't know.
I don't know.
Well, I wanted to...
But, I mean, there's lots of bizarre little places. We got Left Hand, and we got Fraser's Bottom, and, yeah.
Before going, I wanted to share this with people, and I think people will find this interesting. There's an article by Paul B. Farrell at Market Watch, and he says, Sinking Sensation... Democracy is rigged. Still, we feel it, as Frank Rich put it in the New York Times, what disturbs Americans of all ideological persuasions is the fear that almost everything, not just government, is fixed or manipulated by some powerful hidden hand. This pervasive public mood isn't just about the banks, public enemy number one. What the Great Recession has crystallized is a larger syndrome that Obama tapped into during the campaign. It's the sinking sensation that the American game is rigged. That as the president typically puts in a month after his inauguration, the system is in hock to the interests of powerful lobbyists or the wealthiest few who have run Washington far too long. He promised to smite them. He can't. Why? Because like the rest of us, he's controlled by the new lobbyist nation of America. Obama's new inside this happy conspiracy, working with lobbyists like Daschle, an aggressive competing for their slice of a $9 trillion pie for rich clients, as taxpayers sailed the good ship, American Titanic deficits into a huge iceberg dead ahead. Stop kidding yourself. Wake up. You're in denial in fantasy world, dreaming of a new American democracy. Wrong. You no longer live in a democracy. Lobbyists run Washington. They even have their own greed-driven operating rules guiding members working inside Washington's biggest business. Here are some of the principles in the manifesto of this new lobbyist nation of America. This is real behavioral economics in action. Number one, lobbyists destined to fill a void left by democracy's failings. Voters are irrational, cannot be trusted to act without guidance from lobbyists. Number two, lobbyists are the new behavioral nudgers guiding America. Forget behavioral scientists. Special interest lobbyists will do the real nudging. Number three, lobbyists must nudge voters to elect friendly politicians. Lobbyists must invest millions to elect officials favorable to special interests. Number four, lobbyists are the new unseen hand of American capitalism. Capitalism's new unseen hand is the enlightened deals of 261,000 lobbyists. Number five, lobbyists will guide economic recovery for special interests. Congress, the president, and regulators all have a price. Find it and pay it. Number six, lobbyists protect special interests using taxpayers' money. The wealthy will have ready access to the assets and credits of the Treasury. Number seven, lobbyists amass extra capital anticipating a new meltdown. Plan ahead for the next recession by stockpiling benefits for your clients. Number eight, lobbyists hire new blood directly from inside government. The contacts of senators and congressmen are worth millions to clients. Number nine, lobbyists reward politicians, treat like co-lobbyists. Everyone in Washington wants to get rich off big government. Help them. Number 10, lobbyists must defeat programs unfavorable to clients. Programs that weaken the power of the rich must be aggressively defeated. Number 11, lobbyist clients' interests come before public interest. Principles of fiduciary duty mean clients take precedence over public needs. Number 12, lobbyists must defeat or gut financial literacy programs. Intelligent, informed investors undercut special interests. Kill the CFPA. Number 13, lobbyists give traders access to commercial bank assets. Investment banks switch to get access to deposits for high-risk trading. Number 14, lobbyists never help mortgagees and credit card holders. Helping failing homeowners and cardholders means less for bank insiders. Number 15, lobbyists want cap-and-trade derivatives for a new bull market. America needs a new bubble, a new bull. Global warming trades will do trick. And number 16, lobbyists must reward the rich, eliminate inheritance taxes, assures continuity of wealth, of wealthy gene pools.
Jiminy Christmas.
Yeah, you know how dead on this guy is?
I wish he wasn't. I mean, that reads like a list of what's wrong with our government.
Yeah, that's the problem. The problem is like I said, what it has to do with courage and speaking out and bravery and thinking through the, as I say, the macaroni salad swamp. And we don't do that enough. And we need to start doing that, because as much as I like to hear about the madness of the right wing, I'm looking at the madness of D.C. right now, and it keeps getting worse and worse. And there's only so much that I can listen to regarding what a pundit is saying. When I look at things like this, Bob, I look at my future and I say...
But isn't he a pundit in his own right?
Oh, the guy who said this?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess in a sense he is. But most of what he said regarding about what's happening in Washington D.C. is pretty much what's happening to us right now. I may have a little bit of disagreements on some of these things, but I may think some of these points are of a common sense. But at the end of it, I'm left with the conclusion that there needs to be some changes. there needs to be some serious reform. And if we don't have the reform that we want, that we want as American people.
Well, okay, then let's talk about, David, let's talk about what that reform is.
Bob, we need to seriously let people know that somehow, I don't know how we do this, but we need to let people know that Washington just can't be Washington D.C. can no longer be this front running for these lucrative special interests. We need to set some new guide rules, or attempt to, at least. I don't think we've really.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. Let's do a little skull sweating here. A little brainstorming.
Okay.
You know that my family and I have been to Washington, D.C. a couple of times to go, and you know the term that's used is lobby.
Right.
We have gone and we have spoken to aides inside various and sundry congressional offices to urge the passage of a couple of bills, H.R. 1310 and S-696.
Mm-hmm.
They would end mountaintop removal. Now, we didn't have any money for these people. We didn't have any contributions to their PACs. The only thing we had was the profundity of our existence and the strength of our arguments, both of which were significant. On the other hand, we are opposed by an array of coal companies, coal associations, even the government of this state itself. The day after we had a meeting with the Council on Environmental Quality, the governor of West Virginia came up to gainsay everything we had said. We met with a staffer for CEQ. The governor met with the top dog of CEQ. What I'm getting at, David,
mm-hmm.
is that if you want to change the way this structure works, there is one place to begin and only one place to begin, and that's money.
Mm-hmm.
I have argued 1,000 times, if I have argued it once, that that you could write a one-sentence bill that simply says, no elected representative who is a member of Congress nor any member of their staff shall be permitted to accept so much as one penny from any outside individual.
Mm.
Okay? And then you say the penalty for violating this section of the code shall be not less than 10 years nor more than life in the federal penitentiary.
Mm.
And a fine up to of $1 million. 10 million. 20 million. Okay? Make it clear, concise, and plain. And that would mean that all these PACs would go away. You'd have to write it in such a way to make sure that the PACs couldn't be contributed to either. Because I don't care how much the right wing screams, David, money is not speech. Speech is speech. Human communication is speech, and giving money is not human communication. It is bribery. And once you have gotten that out of the system, then suddenly the worthwhileness of lobbyists is dramatically reduced, and you have ideas competing against ideas instead of ideas competing against vast sums of money. Do you? I mean, and I know the answer to this. It's kind of a rhetorical question. Do you actually think the health care debate in this country would be what it is right now if there weren't billions of dollars being pumped into it? Is there really a competing idea that is equally valid to the notion that human illness, agony, misery, and death is not a fitting vehicle for the profit motive? Is there a counter argument to that has any merit whatsoever? You know, yes, it is.
people should be able to profit on another human being's agony? Really? Does that idea, does that argument really have merit if it isn't supported by millions and billions of dollars? Do you get my meaning?
Yeah, I get your meaning on it.
So if you take the money out, then it's not really worthwhile to employ an army of lobbyists. Then the ideas are discussed on their own merits. And meanwhile, at the same time you're doing that, enact meaningful election reform. Meaning that we fund elections. The public funds elections. Everybody running gets the same money. How they choose to spend it is their business, but they get the same money. Clean elections bills are introduced in legislatures all over the country every year. We keep introducing them here in West Virginia. The people who are on the take keep killing them.
Do we have the money now to run
sure.
our candidates?
Sure. That's the thing. These are publicly funded campaigns. That means that when you go to register, go and register to run, you get an account out of which you can spend X number of dollars. Now, most of these proposals are not mandatory. It needs to be mandatory. You know, one of the things that has not happened as much as I would like to have is to see this argument advanced on the back of Don Blankenship, who became a poster child for corrupt political giving. If you don't want your government bought, you have to enact clean election reform. And I mean, I'm not a simplicist, but I genuinely believe, and there's that dangerous word.
Yeah.
I genuinely believe that if you take the money out, the lobbying problems go away.
How many things do you think Obama can cave in before he loses the progressive base? Is this it? Is this the health care, the public
health? I think it may very well be. Keith Olbermann has declared that if Obama does not have a public option in health care reform, he will have a challenger in the Democratic primary in 2012. And I don't think Obama wants that. Jimmy Carter had that in the form of Senator Kennedy in 1980. Look how that worked out for Jimmy Carter.
Do you think he'll have enough support in 2012 after all is said and done with all of the constant hammering of the media on Obama and his policies, calling him a communist and so forth?
I don't think you can talk about 2012 yet, quite honestly, David. I think you have to talk about 2010.
Right.
And there is a possibility that the House, I think all it would take would be 44 votes or some such, or 44 seats. 44 seats would put the Republicans in charge of the House in 2010. That is not statistically impossible. And the less decisively the Congress acts on health care, on things that really matter in this country, the more likely they make a Republican majority in the House. And that just makes me nauseated to even say, but it's true.
As the great Warren Zevon once said, it's time to hit somebody.
Yeah. Sherrod Brown, senator from Ohio, good liberal, has said that it's time that the Democratic Party stop taking progressives for granted. I read that and I went, whoa. Really? You said that? And he did.
Do you think the White House will let go of Van Jones? Just to end on a nice,
no,
cheery note.
No.
You don't?
No.
I don't think they'll
hang him out to dry.
I hate to be ultra cynical, but Beck may as well change his program to the Van Jones Hour, because he literally does talk about it nonstop, and he has so many quotes from his speeches that I don't know, Bob. I saw that the White House said they still stand by him, and that's not it. To me, that's like I look at that.
Is it a kiss of death?
Yeah. I look at that and I'm like, wow, these guys really are afraid of what Glenn Beck says over Van Jones. That's some craziness right there. You can't. They are not willing to stand up and go, no, I don't think we'll apologize because we believe in difference of opinions, and nobody's willing to do that. It's amazing.
And well, again, we don't. You know, the other side doesn't do apologize. That's our job.
Yeah, I know. And the thing is this is what people need to understand. The first people are going to be sacrificed. I'm not naive to know that. You're not naive in that respect. We know the first people are going to be sacrificed, but they won't be forgotten. They'll be picked up by progressive think tanks or op-eds or book deals. But for God's sake, somebody needs to stop apologizing. And the person who does, Bob, the person who does opens the door for a new wave of progressives to come through. And they go, whoa, these guys are strong. I like these guys.
Well, look, you know, the day after the election, David, I said I had five words for the Republican Party. And I've still got them. It's just that they're apparently not being used in the halls of power. Sit down and shut up.
And you know, one last thing. I think, are you going to be on September 7th, is it?
Labor Day? Most likely not.
Most likely not. Oh, okay.
Well, let's see. Four. No, that's Monday night. That's Labor Day night.
Oh, that's Labor Day night.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because we're approaching the. I just thought I'd mention this. We're approaching the 6th anniversary of Warren Zevon. Yeah. Believe it or not.
Yeah, wouldn't he be nice to have around right now?
Yeah, he would be, but. You know, we got a few people left. But anyways, Bob, it was good talking to you, and I hope people take. I hope people understand who are listening now that. Really, Bob, when it comes down to, here's my quote of the day. Why should I apologize for opinion? I mean, really, why? Why should anyone? If it's not hurting anyone, and you really think this, or you have a difference of opinion like this, do we really live in a country where, as from the left and progressives, that we really have to apologize every single time? Are we really endangering America like that? Are we? I don't think so. So that's my question for everybody. Why should we apologize for a worldview opinion? I don't expect. You know what? I don't want anyone to apologize for shit. If they have that opinion, then stand by it, for God's sakes. It's not going to hurt me. It's not going to hurt you. It's just going to say, well, that's what you think.
Stand up for what you believe in. And you know what? The right wing believes absolutely insane, lunatic garbage, but they, by God, stand up for it.
That's right. And,
us?
And, you know,
nah, not so much. Well, you know,
let
maybe we need to apologize.
Let me tell you how surreal the right-wing world is in Fox World. I don't know if you heard this, but did you hear they got the lead singer from GWAR to host the Fox show?
Oh, Jesus. Well, it was bad enough when I saw that Imus was coming to the still coughing up blood on the porch Fox Business Network.
They're laughing at us, and they're laughing at us all the way to the bank. But you know what, Bob, in closing? That bank is open to us, too. It is. We can be enriched by knowledge, experience, and different forms of wealth, generosity, and the common good for man. But, you know, we need to start right now. I got to tell you, I don't want to see the White House apologize anymore. I want to see someone stand up and say...
No, I want to see the White House... never mind the apologies. I want to... no. How do I put this? Not only do I not want to see any more apologies, I want to see some in your face. See,
right.
They were successful. And did they not notice this? That they were successful when they were wearing out Rush Limbaugh and making him the de facto head of the Republican Party? Did they not notice that that was successful? Did they not notice that that excited progressives and liberals? Did they not notice that? Did they not know that it was inspiring to see somebody finally stop apologizing and start standing up and fighting back?
You know, Bob, I think they're going to take Glenn's bait. I was glancing at the program this week, and he said he wants answers from the White House. I think eventually they're going to do what they shouldn't do, and they're going to respond to this lunatic.
But you think they shouldn't? I think maybe they should. I think maybe
anything that they say to Glenn Beck, he's going to pull out that conspiracy theory Mel Gibson chart and just push.
But that just makes him look nuttier, David. No, all you do is you come out and say, "Well, that's fine. That's what a junkie thinks." He's a junkie.
Yeah.
He's a drunk. That's what a dry drunk thinks. That's, well, you know that. Oh, he said that. Well, I guess you can expect that to be said by a dry drunk.
I don't know.
And then they'll foment their outrage, and you just, and look, David, just wait, okay? Just give me a sec. Way back, when I was on terrestrial radio in Beckley, I did this little thing where I explained a group that I call the Stump Licker Bunch, okay? It used to be a thing in the Deep South that when it came time for making your molasses, you know, you had the mule there and he walks in a circle and he turns the grinder and the grinder crushes the cane or the sorghum, you know, the sorghum or whatever, and the juice comes out, and then you boil down the juice and that's where you get sorghum molasses. All right? It's literally a syrup. The juice is a syrup, just like crushing sugar cane yields a sweet syrup. Well, you'd skim that. As it's boiling down, you skim it, because, you know, you got bits outside and you got bugs flying around and stuff, and you skim that and skim it and skim it and skim it and dump it in an old holler stump. And when you're done, you go away and that stuff sits in the stump and it ferments. And it's nasty. And the name for that stuff is stump liquor. All right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was not uncommon for people to go and drink that stuff. And just get crazy drunk. Stupid drunk. Mean drunk. And do god-awful mean things, get in fights and knife each other and all kind of... And I used to refer to the right wing as the Stump Licker Bunch. Because somebody that's wasted on stump liquor will come up and punch you in the face just to see what you'll do back. And if you'd say, "Oh, that wasn't very nice, I'm not going to hit you back, though," they'll hit you in the face again, and they'll knock you to the ground. And once you're on the ground, they'll start kicking you in the ribs and stomping you in the guts and kicking you in the balls and pissing on your face.
You know, Bob, by you saying this, and I'm going to end it on this, this could literally fund the horn by brewing your own stump liquor and selling it on the horn.
Nah, you don't want to touch this stuff. It's nasty. It's got, like, dead yellow jackets in it and stuff. I mean,
I think you could sell it to them.
But the whole point of this, though, David, is that that side is them. That's what that side is. And to this day, we have still not figured out that there is profound value when that sucker comes up and punches you in the face for you to just beat the living piss out of him till he's the one on the ground and say, "Get up, son of a bitch, get up!" And if he does, do it some more. That's the only thing that the Stump Licker Bunch understands, David. And that's the only, and force met with force is the only thing that the right wing understands. You want to shut Glenn back up? You go back at Glenn Beck as hard as Mike Malloy has a couple of nights ago. As hard as I have here. As hard as Guy James has. You wear him the hell out. You know, this is a guy who posted while he was still at CNN. This is a guy who posted his suicidal ideations that he had while he was doped out of his mind on painkillers after having hemorrhoid surgery. That's this guy. He had hemorrhoid surgery that was paid for in a private hospital by his private health care plan, and then used that argument to try to argue that there shouldn't be universal single-payer health care. He's... God almighty damn, he's insane. Some people think, well, you know, just ignore the insane guy. He'll stop screaming as soon as he gets sane. They don't get sane, David! I'm not yelling at you. You understood. No, but you just kind of lit a little fire under me, and...
Yeah, I understand that. I just think, personally, from my point of view, in my mind, I think the new prototype of the right winger is generating on that outrage and wants somebody to fight. Personally, that's what.
Classic case. Okay, you got to go. It's the top of the hour. Okay. You said before I go about 10 minutes ago, and I kept you on, and I apologize.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a little break, and I got a classic example of that, okay?
All right.
All right. Okay. Later, David. Bye now. That's Horn pop culture correspondent David with so much more than pop culture. We're going to go back to the phones, and I want to tell you a little story at the top of the hour, but we will go back to the phones. You know the number, of course, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on 304-658-3333. Email to bobkincaid@gmail.com. David mentioned Warren Zevon. Here's a little. Right here on America's Liberal Voice, The Horn.
Went home to watch TV. And it's worse when I try to remember. Straight down. I can see it with my eyes closed. Run straight down.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95? Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Bob.
Yes, indeed. And back to the phone in just a couple of minutes, but there's a couple of things. I want to go to the mailbag and then draw out an example based on what David was talking about just a couple of minutes ago. Some stuff on the great speech controversy. Jesus, the idea that we've got a conduit. The manufactured speech controversy, come on. Jude writes in from Seattle, a reminder, as you well know, that the Dominionists have seated themselves into all levels of government, federal and local. My understanding is that some local school boards are the ones making the decision to question if the children must hear President Obama speak this Tuesday. In providing a way for parents to decline access for their children, the opportunity to experience the manner in which the president will present himself, once again, it is segregation blatantly exposed. Hallelujah, Jude. Amen, amen, amen. You so get it. Delusional people are very openly challenging at our local school level now in our own neighborhoods. To some degree, this has been occurring slowly for some time. One just needs to read the Wedge Project that came out of the Discovery Institute based here in Seattle and is the hub for intelligent design, a multi-phased plan, one of which was to position themselves at the local school board level. They are the Dominionists. They have raised their terror alert level, and it will affect your and my children, grandchildren, kids. Are very intuitive and will be aware if classmates are not with them to listen to the President of the United States of America speak in their classroom. And for God's sakes, they will know. How many will want to know why? The thought police are on the move. Peace. Jude. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they are. And along those lines, this from our buddy David in South Carolina, who has seen the really seamy side of a bunch of this garbage. David says, it's disrespectful to the President of the United States for permission forms to be sent home so students can opt out of a speech by the President on the topic of education. The people ranting about his upcoming speech are the same folks who wave little Chinese-made American flags at rallies and shout down those of us who wanted to opt out of Iraq. Someone here actually said that they have to send out forms because President Obama is the first Muslim president. There's no use for me to even respond to these idiots anymore if they are this stupid. But why are all these idiots given any credibility at all? I haven't watched any cable news, but I've been following a local story on local media, and local stations treat these permission forms and protests over President Obama's speech as legitimate and attempt to show both sides. Excuse me, but sometimes one of the sides is just full of crap. The right-wing idiots never get called out for being racist idiots. And this from Juanita. This is the news account from the school board where she lives in Florida. Headline, Polk School District Protocol for President Obama's September 8th speech. It's like he's coming. Huh! The superintendent's office has announced its directive to schools regarding the broadcast of President Obama's September 8th speech. A determination of whether the speech will be broadcast live in schools is a school-based decision and will be made by principals and teachers at individual schools. I will add parenthetically where weird-ass little fundamentalist batshit crazy people can exert more pressure on them. The content of the speech, which is to be released Monday by the White House, will be provided to school staffs so that they may determine if the content is appropriate based on students' ages, curriculum, and class schedule considerations. Holy Moses! When did we start questioning whether or not the President of the United States would have speech content appropriate to school-age children? When did that happen? It happened when we inaugurated that one. God, all the, you know, there's been a lot of lunacy, and there's been a lot of typical, to-be-expected, right-wing gasbag meanness. But they may have really, really, honest-to-jeebus, jumped the shark on this one. The release of the content of the speech will allow schools to fully analyze the situation. I'm sorry. Where was the content analysis when George Bush went to read My Pet Goat Upside Down at an elementary school in Florida on September the 11th, 2001? Where was that? Where was the newspaper article stating that George Bush would be subject to analysis of whether his words to first graders in a reading program would be age appropriate? Damn it all! More from the story. If schools decide to broadcast the speech live, schools will provide an opt-out provision for parents or guardians preferring that their children not view the speech.
I don't want little Rafis to see that one on the TV box. I'd rather he was home watching soap operas and dirty movies with me and the old man.
Students may be excused from participating and given an alternative activity if parents communicate to the school with their preference of opting out. We're talking about the President of the United States here. And a televised address. Who in the hell do these people think they are? I'm 46 years old. I'll soon be 47. I have never in my life seen anything like this. I don't think this has ever happened in the history of television. The text of President Obama's speech will be posted to the school district's website. The speech will be recorded and rebroadcast on the school district's cable and fiber optic television channels at a later time. This will allow parents the opportunity to view the speech in the company of their children at a later time if they so wish.
Look at that one, Johnny. Now, there's no reason one of those people should be president. He's a Muslim, communist, socialist. And, oh, my God, little Johnny, what are they doing to your America?
Yeah, you want... Oh, Jesus. The broadcast time is undetermined at this point and will be provided to schools at a later time. The school district's cable television channels are Bright House Networks Channel 614, Comcast Channel 7, and Verizon Floss Channels Channel 45. Well, we know what the next boycott's going to be by the right-wing racist bigots, don't we? The level of David in South Carolina is right. The level of disrespect inherent in this is simply stunning. Emily, who still persists in calling me Mr. Kincaid, and I wish she would stop, it's Bob. Not stop emailing, just call. Quit calling me Mr. Kincaid. God, it makes me feel older than I am. I get another white hair every time I see Mr. Kincaid. Emily says, I have a long weekend, so I get to listen tonight.
Yay.
I was thinking earlier about the parents who are in anger over President Obama's speech and calling him a socialist. My question is, how many of those parents have their kids in public school? Now, isn't that socialism? My head wants to explode over the stupidity. And slightly off topic, but news you'll be interested in hearing, from our pal Allison, formerly of Idaho, now safely ensconced in Seattle. Hey, Bob, it's Allison from Seattle, not Idaho. I've missed you the past few days, but as I try to wrangle all my stuff into some representation of a house, explore my new city, and puzzle over the public transit system, I once was lost on a Washington, D.C. subway for 5 hours, so I'm public transportation illiterate, I'm already breathing a lot easier. I've met more people of another race in 1 week than I did in my entire lifetime on the other side of the state. Rather than an area bound and gagged by a conservative stronghold and where someone of a different race or sexual orientation sticks out like a sore thumb, I live in a place where one can be oneself, whoever that may be, and fit in somewhere. I've been to big cities before but never lived in one. It's like someone has handed me a new life. For 22 years, I've been told I can live in a free country where I can make myself into anything I please. For the first time, I feel like I'm not drowning in mediocrity and negativity, and I actually can create something special. I'll be listening, Bob. Love, Allison. You know, it makes me happy to hear that. It makes me really happy to hear that. Because I know both of those senses, that sense of being drowned in idiocy and that sense of just, wow, look at the world around me. And when you get the wow, look at the world around me feeling, it's like being thirsty as can be and hot and sweaty and drinking cold water. It's that refreshing. Now, quickly, the story before I go back to the phones, which I'm really, really going to do. I told you that God only knows what was wrong with me. I watched a little bit of Fox today, and it was in particular, it was that freak Neil Cavuto, who was having an absolute orgasm on the air because we have video of the man who bit the finger off the... You know this story? The right wing is having an absolute poop hemorrhage over it. There was a protest, I think somewhere in our Arizona, on a street corner. And a Medicare recipient who was there to protest Obamacare got his pinky bitten off by somebody who disagreed with him. Now, the way it was presented for the first 45 minutes that I saw, because it was just sort of, you know, on in the background while I was working, a conservative protester has had his finger bitten off, and they ran clips of Hannibal Lecter. You know, that one. Some fava beans and a nice Chianti. That one. And made references to cannibalism. And we're going to find you. And showed video of the person they think did it walking away from some camera shot somewhere. Have you seen, and Cavuto in that series, have you seen this man? He's a dangerous criminal. And then at the very end, after all this horsepucky and malarkey, at the very end, the guy, Cavuto, says, you know, I interviewed the victim, and they've got a still up next to Cavuto's head of the wrapped arm with the little finger that covered up and missing, and the story of the hero who found the finger and called 9. We have audio of the 911 call. I just found a finger, and I want to know where the feller went to the hospital at so I can take his finger back and I can sew it on. It was theater of the absurd. And only at the very end, in attempting to cajole some sort of, you know, we'll catch him dead or alive from some law enforcement agent, only at the end did Cavuto get around to mentioning, well, this all started when the conservative went up and punched the person who disagreed with him in the face. What was I saying to David about the stump licker bunch just walking up and punching you in the face and laughing and waiting to see what you'll do? Stump licker bunch. Well, the guy punched him in the face once and wasn't content with it. I guess because the liberal didn't run away crying or fall to the ground where he could start kicking him. So, having punched him once in the face, the conservative then punched him a second time in the face, at which point the conservative freak's pinky wound up in the guy's mouth, and either voluntarily or involuntarily, the guy chomped. We're primates. Our teeth are effective for such things from time to time. But the whole thing was about the cannibal must be caught. And yet it was the right-winger who started the fight. And even knowing that, they continue to scream that the victim of the attack is the problem. Do we need a more glaring example of what it means to be a right-winger in this country today? You can walk up and punch someone in the face, no charges are filed against you, and you wind up calling yourself a victim because the person defended himself with what he had at hand at the moment, namely his teeth. I guess you can't really have your teeth at hand unless you've got dentures, but you get my meaning. Now, do you see why I said I wanted to tell this story when I explained the stump licker bunch to David from Maine? I reiterate, right-wingers and conservatives in this country can literally walk up to another human being, punch them in the face once, get away with it, punch them in the face twice. And when some attempt at maybe self-defense is engaged, scream about how they have been attacked. That's what makes it ever so important that we finally learn to treat bullies like bullies. I know it is not difficult for you to understand, but I do not know what is necessary to make the rest of the so-called liberal Democrats understand it, too. This from our pal Cindy, who notes that Ronnie Reagan preached tax cuts at children. November 14th, 1988, to be particular. He addressed and then took questions from students from four area middle schools in the old executive office building. It was broadcast live and then rebroadcast by C-SPAN, and Instructional Television Network fed the program, quote, to schools nationwide on three different days. During his speech, Reagan, who at that point in time, November 4th, 1988, was already in the clutches and full throes of Alzheimer's disease, wandered off down the garden path, metaphorically speaking, and said, well,
Today, to a degree never before seen in human history, one nation, the United States, has become the model to be followed and imitated by the rest of the world. But America's world leadership goes well beyond the tide toward democracy. We also find that more countries than ever before are following America's revolutionary economic message of free enterprise, low taxes, and open world trade. These days, whenever I see foreign leaders, they tell me about their plans for reducing taxes and other economic reforms that they are using, copying what we have done here in our country. So, school children, I want to tell you that no matter what your teachers have told you, copying is okay. No, you didn't say that last part. No. What we have done here in our country. I wonder if they realize that this vision of economic freedom, the freedom to work, to create and produce, to own and use property without the interference of the state, was central to the American Revolution, when the American colonists rebelled against a whole web of economic restrictions, taxes, and barriers to free trade.
And all President Obama's going to talk about is staying in school and being persistent in trying to get good grades. Now you tell me, by God Almighty, you tell me who was trying to indoctrinate children. Mao style. Okay, we go back to the phones now, I promise.
Oh.
Hey, welcome to the program.
It's me, Richard.
Hey, Richard.
I didn't expect to get on so suddenly.
Sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got a couple of things on my mind today. First of all, you know, I was going to get hold of George Miller.
Right.
And I still don't have an answer from them. I called his local office, and they said, we haven't got an answer back from Washington yet. So it's been something like 3 weeks, I think. And we still don't know why he voted against Kucinich's, what was it, an amendment?
Yes, it was an amendment.
Yeah. So I still don't have an answer, but I did get a mailing, printed mailing from his people about health care. And it attacks the problems very nicely. But... And it talks about goals, but it mysteriously leaves out anything involving public anything. In other words, no single payer, not even public option. But regulation, heavy regulation. So I'm a bit bugged, you know. It looks like I'm going to have to call Kucinich's people to find out what's going on between Miller and Kucinich. But I suspect that there's something between them.
Meaning what?
Well, you know, it's politics. Miller tends to be a good guy, but he's not a rabble-rouser. You know, he doesn't disturb stuff. He doesn't confront very much. Whereas... Kucinich is a good in your face kind of guy, and Kucinich sings my song. So I'm interested in hearing what's going on from his side. You know, if there's any bad blood between them, I'm curious. You know what? To know what's been going on. Am I making sense?
Yes, I do. You are.
You know, I mean, in other words, if I don't get an answer from Miller, well, why don't I try Kucinich? I mean, I'm bugged that, it's my attitude is that when Kucinich introduces anything, I want Miller to be on board. As I said, Kucinich is singing my song. And Kucinich introduced at least two proposals while Bush was in office, you know, on the impeachment path, and Miller did not support him. Very few people did.
Right.
And, you know, I want him to. So I called about that, and I got, you know, some gobbledygook response about, you know, that he feels this isn't the way to do it and that there are more important priorities. And, of course, I mean, who knows if any traction could have been gotten on impeachment. Probably.
Well, we don't know precisely because we didn't give it a go now, did we?
No, we didn't. But the, you know, we were in the thrall of the neocons at the time. My gut sense is that it wouldn't, you know, it would have gained some traction, but that would have been about it. I'm upset that nobody really tried. And meanwhile, how many more Americans died? I mean, granted, would impeachment have stopped the carnage in Iraq? Who knows? Probably not, but, you know, I'm upset that nobody tried. Actually, okay, I have to say, yeah, somebody tried. There were a few people who got on board with Dennis. But I'm just talking about my guy who didn't do it.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Right. You know, I need a little. You know, it's a rough call because Miller's been a good guy. You know.
Well, yeah, and he still is. That's what was disturbing about this. It seemed an easy call to make.
Right. But the answer may lie in the shape of his district, which I think I should study a bit more. You know, it could be that he's got a bit more moneyed people in his district than I'm aware of. I know he's got some. Most of my county, at least, it is strange. I mean, it's all chopped up. There's one city, as I mentioned to you before, which is really, really poor.
Mm-hmm.
The big one. That's Richmond. But then there's Concord, which is extremely right-wing, you know, and fundamentalist. And everything.
And has enough money to burn a wet elephant.
Well, no, not Concord.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Concord is strange. I mean, you know, it's they have, you know, loudmouth right-wing Christian ministers. And, you know, weirdness. We have, geographically, we have this strange arrangement here where there's a mountain range, and I'm on the west side. You guys would call it mountains. We call them hills out here. And
well, we call them hills around here, too.
Anyway, I'm on the west side of a ridge that's called the Berkeley Hills. And so these right-wingers are more on the east side of those hills. And it's a different weather system. And the county is very, very big compared to, you know, it's a California-sized county. It's huge.
Right.
I mean, it takes me 45 minutes at least to drive from one side of the county to the other at freeway speeds. So this gives you so much.
That's a bunch of county.
Yeah, that's big. And of course, when you look at Los Angeles County,
then again, in California, freeway speeds can mean 15 miles an hour, Richard. So you better be careful.
No, I'm talking 65. But anyway, you know that's the Miller business, and you know, it's funny. I haven't mentioned this before, but the HMO that I'm involved with, as I've mentioned before, is the first government-operated HMO in the whole country, and it's well over 20 years old, and it piggybacks on top of the county's health system. Now, I completely forgot that for many years, year after year, we've been voted the best HMO in the whole Bay Area. That says a lot. This is in terms of member satisfaction. So here we have a government operated agency.
Why isn't that some sort of huge glaring headline in the Chronicle or something?
The thing is that we just don't blow our horn, you know.
Well, maybe that's a phone call you need to make.
I don't even know to who. You know,
to a reporter, somebody at the city desk of the Chronicle.
Okay.
Or the regional disc.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they circulate over here. Yeah, it's.
I mean, I got to figure that's the biggest newspaper in the area, right?
Because
you're a little far off for the Sacramento Bee or some such.
That's correct. Yeah, the Chronicle is. The San Jose Mercury News has a time.
Well, that yeah.
Bigger, but it's very hard to say. So the Chronicle is published by Hearst, and all the other papers in the whole Bay Area are published by this right-wing fundamentalist who lives in Denver. Rick Singleton is his name, and he owns everything other than the Chronicle. So he owns the San Jose Mercury News. That's a whole other ball game. But the funny thing was I didn't know about this health system until one day I was riding on BART and I saw this poster that said this is the best kept secret in Contra Costa County, you know, and it is. But the thing is, we're not used to blowing our horn, you know, we don't advertise.
Well, and that's. That's something I think that spans the whole healthcare debate, Richard, is that we have not, people have done some, I'm not saying it hasn't been done at all, we have not done a good enough job because we only do it when it's under attack. You know, it's only when it's under attack that we come out and say, hey, Social Security is a liberal idea, it's run on a less than 4% administrative costs, and it does a great job.
You know,
same thing with Medicare.
Right, and with, same thing with a lot of stuff.
And some of that's attitude, Richard. Maybe the way we say it is, hey, until you come up with something like Medicare that's run on less than 4% overhead, shut up. Maybe it's time we cop an attitude with these bastards.
I'm agreeing with you. We're not used to having a megaphone in our hands.
We're not used to standing up for what we believe in, Richard.
Well, I can only talk about my own case. It's frustrating. I've been thinking back. I was.
I mean, I'm not gooning on you. You understand?
No. I know that. But the thing that puzzles me is how can we be effective? And I think we can do it, but we need to really think about how we go about it. You know, to be successful. Because I've seen too many times us on the left, we on the left, would. Go at the problem from our own position of frustration, and the thing would backfire in our face.
Right, and especially now because you've got. I understand that side of the coin too, Richard. Because you got something like Fox out there, and I heard them today running. Oh God, who was it? She's a New York congresswoman, and I can't remember Louise Slaughter.
Yeah, where's she from, by the way? Do you know?
She represents Buffalo.
Buffalo, okay, yeah.
And they were running her down on Fox today. Yeah, I'm never going to watch that again. My God, it was just, I just sat there. It was like watching a train wreck. It really was. Not a damn thing you can do about it. Just sit there with a horrified look on your face.
That's it. That's right.
And they, well, you know, she referred to the protesters at the, she said she wouldn't have a town meeting because she didn't want to talk to those people.
God. Well,
because what she said is those people who attend who are attending these things are not grassroots. I know how this is happening. I know what's going on, and I'm not going to subject my personal dignity and the dignity of my office to the abuse that those people hand out. Can't blame her for it, but I tell you, by God, if they could have had her in the room, they would have torn her limb from limb at Fox. And lick the blood up off the floor.
Well, that's, you know, Rupert Murdoch is a real case study. I do not.
Well, that wasn't what I was gonna say. He is, but that'll do.
Well, I mean, I don't know what makes he's a sociopath. I don't know what makes him tick. Something makes him tick, you know. And it's like Rick Goodner, get involved. It's we need the psychologists. We need help. In this, I'm going to talk about when I was a teenager for a moment, because I'm a lot older than you. And I got involved with a movement called the Youth March for Integrated Schools. So you can tell how far back I'm going.
Okay.
I'm talking about the 1950s, Bob. And, you know, we worked very hard, and we all descended on Washington, and we had a demonstration, right? You know, felt really good, made a lot of noise. And there were reporters. And I remember, because I talked with the reporters, and they were all from the foreign press. You know?
Yeah, no local guys.
No local guys. And so I came back, right, you know, exhausted, come back to New York. And the following day, I get all the newspapers. I want to see, you know, what happened? There was nothing about us on television. I didn't hear anything about us on the radio. We were not in the New York Times. We were not in the Hearst papers. We were not in the Daily News. We weren't in the New York Post, which at the time was a liberal paper, if you can believe that. And one paper covered us, and it was called the New York World Telegram and Sun. And I'll never forget the way the article started. It started, "The Youth March for Integrated Schools, comma, a communist-inspired organization, comma." You know, and
I'm not laughing. I mean, you understand why I'm chuckling.
I do. And then there was some other demonstration. I think it was the same, you know, Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy. Yeah, we marched all the way from Coney Island to over the Brooklyn Bridge, and, you know, halfway into Manhattan. And we got booed and threatened. You know, talking New York, this is Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I mean, there's right-wing bastards in, all around New York City, too. It's not a totally liberal paradise.
Archie Bunker was not made up.
Archie Bunker was not made up. Carol O'Connor did such a masterful job on Irish bigotry in that character. You know, it was beautiful. That guy was just... I mean, every ethnic group's got its own bigots, and he tackled his, and he did such a lovely job of it. I miss that guy. But, you know, so I marched over the bridge, and we marched through, if you can believe this, rain, hail, and snow, all on the Brooklyn Bridge. And the next day, I had a fever. And that's not the only time I've been on a demonstration and come down with a fever, by the way. And so, you know, it's like the next... Oh, and then I went into...
It was probably that communist virus working its way into your system, Richard.
I went into our... We had some real estate guy donated a storefront to our cause on 42nd Street. And I went in there. And what did I see? Two communists yelling at each other. One was a Trotskyite. The other one was a Leninist. And they were going at each other with hammers and tongs, and it's like...
And there was a Maoist in the corner waiting to kill whoever survived.
You know, and I'm saying to myself, why am I doing this? You know? So, you know, it's been a puzzle for me ever since. It's like, how do we gain traction? We're smart people. You know, what can we do that's going to really work?
Well, you know what? One of the folks that I met at Netroots Nation, a really great, smart guy, works for Center for American Progress. His name is Mike Elk. And he's been addressing himself to this issue at some length lately, Richard. And if you just look him up over at Huffington Post, you'll find some of his thinking. Mike has been addressing himself to the fact that we so-called liberals do a very, very poor job of reaching out to people within the working class.
Mm.
And so he is addressing himself to those issues because, you know, he's heard, you know, other liberals talking, saying, you know, we don't, and I hate to even put white in here, but it is, you know, we don't need the white working class. We can do this without them. I don't think you can do anything that helps all of America without some significant portion of all of America behind you.
I agree. Definitely.
So it would be. I'm trying to see if I've got the article still up here.
What's his name? While you're looking.
His name is Mike Elk. ELK. He posted a really neat essay over at Huffington Post under the business, I guess, business tab. Mike Elk, stop the teabaggers, give them green jobs, lessons from the coal fields of West Virginia. And he and I have been talking quite a bit, and I've been talking to him about my little theory that that one of the most profound negative influences on the Democratic Party has been the passing away of the New Deal and Depression-era generation. Because it was those people, it was that segment of the population that kept, that put John Kennedy over the top in the primary in 1960 in West Virginia.
Indeed, I remember it well.
And that was, you know, such a stunner.
No, and it was.
And we voted, and we didn't just do, yeah. You know, we didn't go for a Republican presidential candidate until George Bush. George W. Bush. We went for Dukakis.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we went for McGovern. When nobody else did. And I think there's a profound, I won't sit here and read it to you. Just go and have a look, because I do kind of need to ring off and catch a couple more calls. But Mike Elk is the gentleman's name. He's a really good guy and a smart guy and a good writer. Campaign for America's Future. Just look him up under the business section at Huffington Post, Mike Elk, ELK.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be interested to have your thoughts, Richard.
Okay.
And anyone else's, too.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, and have a great Labor Day weekend.
You too, Bob.
All right.
Bye.
Bye. From the Bay Area, that is our good friend Richard. And we roll along.
Hey, Bob.
Well, hey, Juanita. Did I conjure you?
No.
Oh, I was reading that.
You read my email. Yeah, thank you for that. I'll tell you a couple of incidents that went several years apart concerning my area down here. Give you an idea.
Okay.
Because I think that if any school chooses to show that, I think there will be, you'll be hearing about it. It'll be national news, if you know what I mean, it'll be more than a finger. But years ago when my son first started school, I went to my first PTA meeting. And they had a theme of the Harper Valley PTA. Remember that song?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the people in charge and all, and including all of our pediatricians in our town, which at that time was only three. God only knows how many there are now. And they were all against sex education. We're not having sex education in school. Back then. And the upshot is that I was just thinking of percentage-wise, I would say 75% of young girls out here having babies at 13 and 14 and 15, that many. And I'm not talking about blacks. I'm talking about whites.
Sure.
I mean, the blacks always get.
Oh no, no, it's poor black folk that get that get the hammering on, but it's the
right.
Poor. You know, the majority of welfare is collected by poor whites.
Right.
The majority of teen pregnancies are had by poor whites, but of course, coming out of the South and certainly spreading like
right.
Some sickness around our country, and of course, God knows Ronald Reagan helped this a lot with his. The straw woman he created of the
the welfare queen.
The welfare queen, exactly.
Yeah. Well, getting back to that part too, and another thing, when I was growing up, I say 90% of the young guys that grew up out here went to prison for one thing or another. Some of them continually, and some of them changed, you know. Anyway, then cutting back to maybe 10 years ago, we had some of our commissioners came from up north, you know, and it was United Nations Day. And they were flying.
Get us flag. Out of the UN, that communist organization.
Oh, boy. Did that flag go down quickly? You can imagine.
Almost like it fell.
Yeah. So that's the kind of area this is.
Juanita, don't think that that's just where you live. That's the kind of area America is.
And I'm not, I mean, I'm not even in southern Alabama, you know, panhandle.
No, right, I understand, but there's lots of pockets of neckism in Florida, and you and I both know it.
Oh, yeah. But just so people be aware, but I thought, well, that if any school does have the nerve to opt out and show it, God only knows what happened. You know, we had a big confrontational hearing down here with Bill Nelson. People got into some kind of fisticuffs down here. But I understand that the man whose finger was bitten off
started the fight.
Yeah.
Yeah, he threw the first punch.
Yeah, and the guy, what was the guy supposed to do?
Well, no, it's not just that, Juanita. The guy, he threw the first punch, and then he threw a second punch.
Yeah.
And that's when he got his pinky bit off. But you know what? If a guy's attacking you and his finger winds up in your mouth, I'd say 99.9% of humanity going to bite back.
Well,
to make it, because he punched him once and then went to punch him a second time.
Yeah.
That meant he was willing to punch a third, a fourth, a fifth, a sixth. You know, that guy may have lost a pinky, but he may have also lost a murder charge because he was, as usual, one of these delusional, outraged, insane right wingers who's been absolutely ginned into a frothing fury by the likes of Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these AstroTurf organizations.
Well, I've decided that these people hate the United States of America.
As it is presently constituted,
they
do.
They don't want to have any say but themselves, and they don't realize they're a mess of confusion themselves. You know.
Yeah.
If they actually sat down and talked, they would have a lot of disagreements among them. Oh, did you hear what that guy said that had his finger bit off? That he had Medicare. He didn't believe in it, but he did use it for the first time.
Yeah, I'm sure that was. I'm sure it was the very first time.
He don't believe in it.
Yeah, never used it. Yeah, he doesn't believe it. He doesn't believe in it, but it didn't. But there was nothing that was required for him to sign that said he did believe in it because it's a factual reality. It's not subject to Tinkerbellism.
But let everybody know that if they know anything about that guy that did bite the finger off, if they need to call Crime Stoppers if they know the number. I just saw that on the internet.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, frankly, if I was the guy, I think I would turn myself in before the bruises faded and press charges against that crazy bastard. Sorry, I don't mean to use the dirty words. I thought it was Arizona, but maybe I was wrong.
Who knows? I don't know what the incident was down here. I know people came to fisticuffs. It's going to be, if they keep on, it's going to get worse. It almost has to, if people are still taking guns, especially. But anyhow, Bob, I'll tell you, the way I've been feeling, It's one of my favorite songs by the Mike and the Mechanics. Do you remember them?
Mm-hmm.
It's called Taken In.
Taken In. I was thinking.
Taken In, Taken In.
I was thinking more of Silent Running, but yeah.
But it's this song just Taken In again, and we'll know more after Wednesday, won't we?
Well, I think we will. I got to find out now. I mean, school day's over here, and I got to find out if. Well, I don't think we got any forms sent home, but I'm going to have to find out if they showed the if they showed the address.
Oh boy, the way them mountaintop removers act, I don't think they.
Well, and that's
that.
The thing. I really am a little bit nervous about what happens tomorrow. Tomorrow's the big hate fest that they're having down in Logan County.
Oh, what is this now? I don't know if that's...
Oh, there's 25,000-30,000 people going to show up.
Oh, the thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I don't know, but what they're going to come out and start and just, you know, decide to go kill somebody.
Well, didn't they say kill a tree hugger every day? They'll go away?
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
And, of course, you know we're all tree huggers.
Yep. Yeah, we're not trying to save human communities. We're hugging trees.
Did you know that, I mean, I know you know, that everything they're coming out with now that they're saying that we and Obama are doing are the things that actually they were conniving to do?
Yeah.
Such as, weren't they building, who built all those camps? Here in the United States?
That was under the Bush administration, yeah.
Yeah.
But they only discovered them once Obama became president.
Well, I heard about them before then.
Oh, no. I know. You had, I had, normal people
yeah.
had. But the right-wingers only discovered them once a brown man was president because they're just...
Because,
oh, yeah. See, they can't hide their whiteness, and they're afraid it's going to be a roundup for the white people. Oh,
yeah.
My God. You know.
They're killing all, and asked all the Republicans.
Well, like I said,
why
white people.
Black.
Yeah, no, white people. Yeah, the Republican Party is literally white.
Yeah.
I mean, with the exception of Michael Steele, who mocks who mocks girls whose mothers died of cancer 6 months ago.
Yeah.
What a sick one he is.
I saw her interviewed, and she said that they weren't given the opportunity to ask questions, and she did want to get that, and they said she was screaming out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I just wanted to be heard.
Don't blame her.
But anyway, I think it was something else I wanted to say, but I forgot now. But anyhow, I'm trying to look at things in a different light.
They make it a little challenging, don't they?
Oh yeah. But it is so aggravating. And frustrating. And you do feel like we're being sucker punched day after day after day, no matter what.
Ain't that the truth?
And I just felt for Gene. I heard him talking the other night. And it's just heartbreaking. It's so discouraging. It would be so easy. And about that apologizing too. I'm that, and of course I've been against partisanism. You know, bipartisanism.
Yeah.
Partisan, whatever you call it. I've been against that for years now, and I'm so sick of it. And I think, like, if I hear Harry Reid say it one more time, but I think he said it so many times that he can't help himself.
Well, it has become, and I know you know the meaning of this term. Oh, and by the way, Gene says thank you, Juanita.
Oh, he's welcome. Tell him I love him.
It has become, and I know what this term. I know you know what this term is. Bipartisanship is an article of faith to Harry Reid. It is not subject to question anymore. You know what I mean? It is literally a part of the fabric of his being. And he's not able to comprehend anymore, Juanita, that bipartisanship is a fraud and a ruse as long as the Republican Party exists as it presently is.
And he could well lose his seat, too.
Wouldn't hurt me.
He doesn't see it.
Wouldn't hurt me in the least.
Because
you know what? That 60 Democrat majority isn't doing us much good right now.
No.
But, Juanita, I got just a couple of minutes left, and I want to try to get one more phone call in so I don't leave anybody hanging on Friday.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
You take
good
care.
Night, Bob.
Happy
thank
Labor Day.
You too.
Bye. All right. I hope you're still here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm fine.
Well, I just wasted 2 hours this afternoon watching.
Oh, no. That was Chris, our buddy in Idaho. And we lost him. Oh, I hate how that happens. I think he was on hold so long his phone died. Shame on me. But that's the program. Have a happy Labor Day weekend. Listen, I want to mention something before I go, and I'm going to go real fast about this. Last month, we introduced these magnificent prints by our dear friend Diane. And I have it in my hand now, and it is beautiful. It is more beautiful than I could have imagined. These handmade prints for the love of West Virginia. 6 colors on 110-pound cover stock. They are still for sale. We still have some. And for no more than a $75 contribution, you can have one. The information is at headonradionetwork.com. Treat yourself to this. How often do you have a chance at art lovingly made by hand? It certainly would go a long way toward making things, helping September to make sure of an October for the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Thanks to everyone who makes this all happen, and happy Labor Day to all of everyone in whatever manner you participate, listening, moderating, blogging, emailing, phoning, contributing your time, your funds, your energies. Thank you. Thank you to Coal River Mountain Watch for all their many labors. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! is the Friday before Labor Day. And hopefully in the stack, a little bit of a labor story, a working folks story for this evening as we go into the long Labor Day weekend. I don't think I'll be here Monday. I mean, no offense, but I'm not trying to lay down on the job or anything. But I would rather work Christmas Day than work Labor Day. That's the honest to God's truth, I would. Because my reverence is deep for working people, the hardworking people of this country and of this planet, who carry a very, very tiny minority of people who think they are vastly better than the rest of us on our backs every second of every minute of every hour of every day of every week of every month of every year of every decade of every century of every millennium. And so it goes. So, yeah, don't look for me Monday. But if something goes really sideways or you know, if something big happens, I'll be here. But I would prefer to revere and reverence working folks on that day. Because, you know, working people are real. It's not like a lot of holidays where we spend time invoking imaginary creatures and Easter bunnies and leprechauns and things like that. Easter bunnies, leprechauns, honest Republicans, you know, imaginary animals. But anyway, so that's we got a labor story to see. Quick update. Last night was the first game of the middle school football season. Ferg and his team traveled to beautiful Montgomery, West Virginia to face the Valley Middle School Greyhounds. They were pasted. It was 40-20. But it's not as bad as it sounds. That 40-20 was a big case of real first half jitters, and then came back and played some pretty decent ball, just gave up a bunch of big plays, and had some of their own. So for those of you who were wondering how Ferg was, and he did get a badly stoved middle finger. This is football. That happens. He got a badly stoved middle finger, so no flipping the bird for you for a week or two, young man. It hurts, Dad. Well, good. No, he's got a badly stoved middle finger, but played hard, got a couple of good tackles, ran a kid down from behind and tackled him with one arm without grabbing him by the shirt collar, which is nice. I enjoy going to those games. Agnes went with me. The little stadium at West Virginia Tech, I don't know, maybe Bridgemont by now, or Del Monte College of Engineering. I don't know. Little stadium up there is just beautiful. It's cut right into the hillside, and it looks out over the upper Kanawha Valley. Beautiful. Just beautiful. A very happy Labor Day weekend to all of you, first and foremost. And to those of you listening who are members of labor unions, not just a happy Labor Day to you, but a profound and heartfelt thank you. Because it is organized labor that brought us a Labor Day. It is organized labor that brought us a 5-day, 40-hour work week. It is organized labor that brought us things like pensions, things like unemployment compensation, things like workers' compensation, which proved to be so popular and such a good idea that it was ruined in many states by private insurance companies trying to make a profit off of the backs of crippled working people. Where have I heard that before? I could just swear I have. But thank you. Thank you. It was January the 21st, 2009, when Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid promised a room full of progressive media types, myself and Guy James in attendance among them. Oh, we'll have a card check bill by summer. Yeah, not so much. It's summer, card check ain't here. One wonders why. One wonders what happened. I'm hard-pressed to come up with a good answer. Chinless Mitch McConnell, however, minority leader of the Senate, did he lose that chin in an auto accident, or is it some sort of congenital birth defect, or is he just an alien from another planet? I'm not sure. But at any rate, on the second day of September, Mitch McConnell gave a speech to Commerce Lexington. I guess that's the Chamber of Commerce of Lexington, Kentucky. And he said, Chinless Mitch did, while there's a whole bunch of crickets on employee free choice over on the Democratic side of the United States Senate, you know, that it passed the House a long time ago and would pass again. Mitch McConnell told Commerce Lexington that no Republicans, not one, zero, will vote in favor of the Employee Free Choice Act. Not a single Republican will vote to enshrine the guarantees of freedom of association contained in the First Amendment in our labor law. Not one. Not one. And unlike Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell knows how to crack a whip over his caucus. And when he says no Republican will vote for the Employee Free Choice Act, he means zero Republicans will vote for the Employee Free Choice Act, because to do so would imperil every last vestige of power that they hold. And he will wield that power ruthlessly. Chinless Mitch.